I'm semi-retired now, so I don't get to lead retreats like this very often. It used to be frequent and habitual. It's now a rare experience for me, and so it becomes more precious feeling, actually. I've been feeling a lot of gratitude that this can still happen in the world. I'd like to share with you tonight what I call the why and what talk. It's basically to talk about why we do this practice and a little bit about what we do in this practice. And it feels important. The Buddha taught extensively for a period of 45 years. And so his teachings are extensive. They're very coherent. They basically provide a system. We might describe the Buddha as a kind of technician of liberation. He understood in a very subtle way exactly how our minds work, how they work to cause our suffering, and how they work to free us from suffering. And so what I'd like to do this evening is just sum up a little bit some of those teachings to provide the foundation for our practice. It helps to know the context or why. Otherwise, and you might still have the experience tomorrow of saying, now why am I following my breath? There's less chance of that happening. And it feels like, actually, the words that I share with you this evening are the most important words that I'll share in this retreat. And I think I can convey the ideas moderately well. I don't think I can convey how much I love them, how important they are to me personally. So in 1976, a group of young, brave Vipassana teachers had, in the last year or two, had come back from Asia and wanted to introduce Vipassana practice, mindfulness practice, this tradition of the Dharma to North America. And they were very courageous. They decided that Vipassana needed a home in North America, and they started looking for a place, for a home. And they went to the little rural town of Barre, Massachusetts, in central Massachusetts, and they went to look at a Catholic center like this one, thinking to buy it. It had been more or less abandoned by the Catholic Church. It was big. The core what is now Insight Meditation Society is an old, beautiful old mansion that a former lieutenant governor of Massachusetts built for himself, with big columns in the front. And then the Catholics added a big chapel and an annex and a whole new wing. It was a very big place. And it was daunting to them. They were young. They didn't know whether people would come and do practice. They were thinking about buying a place that had thousands of square feet that would need to be filled with people and that would need to be paid for and that would need to be maintained. So they were scared. So they looked at it, and then they went into the town of Barre and were walking around the town common, the green space like a plaza in the middle of all New England villages. They were walking around the common trying to decide whether or not they were going to buy this place. And they came upon a monument. It is now years gone, but they came upon a monument in the middle of the town common that had the town motto of Barre, Massachusetts on it. It's tranquil and alert. And they said, okay, there's our sign. And they bought the place, and they managed to fill it, they managed to maintain it, they managed to pay for it. A whole $125,000 for a very large building and 80 acres. So it seems to me that those two terms, the motto of the town of Barre, Massachusetts, really sum up a lot about our practice. To have a tranquil heart and an alert mind. So, tranquility. on one level, tranquility is simply calm. You know, we've all had the experience of calm. We probably have all appreciated the experience of calm. But on a deeper level, it's a peace on the inside, as it were, that is deep enough to withstand the buffeting of external circumstances. A very deep quality of peace that is very stable. And the Buddha describes this peace in a very beautiful way. He says, the person who is unstained by attachment, that is, who is free from attachment, is refreshed and free, and has entered the ideal state of nirvana, is always at peace. That person is free from all attachments, has removed all suffering from the heart, is tranquil in mind, and is always at peace. Can you even imagine being always at peace in every possible circumstance? That's the promise of the Buddha. And then alert. We've also all experienced being alert, and we probably have all appreciated it. It's simply being conscious. It's being aware of our circumstances. It's being aware of what's happening. Both the external conditions and the internal conditions. If you have observed animals in the wild, you have probably noticed how very alert they are. If you've ever noticed a deer grazing, for example, they're constantly aware not only of the eating process, but of their environment around them. I had an interesting experience a few weeks ago. I flew to Portland, Oregon, and when I came back, I took the airporter to the airport parking lot to pick up my car. And we were a full bus of people, and we got to the very first place, and the guy was going down the row, and the driver was going down the row, and he said, "Well, which is it for the first car?" And the person said, "It's a pickup." And the driver responded, "Well, that's good. That gets us down to about 50 possibilities." So we found the pickup, and he helped them with their bags, and he got back into the bus, and all the rest of us were there, and he said, "I was a smartass, wasn't I?" And we said, "Yeah, you are a smartass." And I happened to be the last car. So everyone else had left the bus, and I drew him out. I said, "You know, it takes a lot of patience to do the work that you do." And he opened up to me, and he shared with me how frustrating it was for him that people are so very unconscious, that they're just not aware. And there was a certain amount of frustration and anger. And I just encouraged patience in him, and I said, "You know, when I've done a long plane trip, I'm kind of numb and dazed." And he said, "That's not an excuse." So I decided about a week and a half ago, I flew again. I flew to Hartford, and I decided to pay attention. You know, I went into the airport. I decided to pay attention to how alert people were, and it was astonishing to me. You know, the first step, of course, when you take a flight is to stand in line in front of the airport counter. And I was flying Southwest, and you know, they have these screens where you can check yourself in. And people were standing in line, and person after person after person didn't notice when one of those machines was free. And people didn't notice when one of the agents behind the counter was free. You know, somebody had to say, "There's one over there." And you know, and then we went up to go through security, and people didn't notice when one of the TSA people was free to check identity, and they didn't notice that there was a shorter line to go through the metal detector, and it was quite interesting. You know, once I had the lenses on, to pay attention to how alert people were, I realized, my goodness. And then just really studying people and the way they moved and what their faces were like. You know, the eyes weren't engaged. The eyes weren't alert. The face wasn't alert. And for many, many people, that's certainly not true of everyone. And I mentioned that I just finished, just very recently on Thursday, I finished a road trip driving from Hartford to Embuto, New Mexico. And so I was in all kinds of truck stops and restaurants, and I continued to pay attention. How alert are people? And I actually felt a little bit what that young driver of the bus felt. I started feeling irritation. Wake up! It doesn't help to be impatient. But why is that? You know, why have we turned off our attention? That is so natural for us, that's natural to us and to all other animals. You know, we animals are meant to be alert. And so many of us humans are not. How have we humans gone so numb? You know, I can speculate about the reasons for that. I think it's an interesting question to investigate, but at another time. For this evening, I think it's enough to say that people often are not tranquil, they're anxious, and people are often not alert, they're turned off, they're numb. Do you personally prefer to be tranquil or anxious? Is there a value in tranquility, especially the tranquility that the Buddha is talking about? And do you personally prefer to be alert or numb? Is there a value in having a clear, receptive awareness of what's happening? If you're interested in these things, you're in the right place. Because we can actually offer, and many of you certainly know this, I've practiced it for years and years as I look around the room, we can offer tools that will help you to become more tranquil and more alert. Two of those tools are ones that we will emphasize throughout this retreat. Actually, one of them is a mind that is more concentrated. And calm comes with a more concentrated mind. As your mind is wandering less, as you're able to turn your attention to something and to hold it more steadily, more and more steadily on the object, that kind of steadiness brings tranquility. And sometimes profound tranquility. In a sense, concentration is tranquility. And mindfulness will help your mind and heart to be more alert. And it is, mindfulness is, awareness is alertness to both internal, quote-unquote, and external, quote-unquote, conditions. I feel that these qualities, being tranquil and being alert, are useful for us in all possible circumstances. You know, it's very rare. You know, I can think of just one circumstance right off the bat where it's not useful to be alert, and that is if we're severely traumatized, we have to shut down our senses. And that's fine. But unless we're traumatized, we're much more likely to survive if we can be alert to our circumstances. It helps in all circumstances, but I think it may even save your life and the life of others in an emergency if you can stay alert. If you can stay both tranquil and alert in an emergency situation, you may have done that in your life. It has happened to me a couple of times in my own life where I've been in very dangerous situations where I've been able to stay very calm and very clear. And as I look back on it, I feel very grateful for this practice. But as wonderful as these things are, tranquility and alertness, The Buddha's teaching offers us a lot more. He said something I've quoted hundreds of times. You know, he reduced the teachings really to one sentence. He said, "I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering." He showed us how we suffer in our lives, and he said, "This can cease, this can be uprooted, this can end." The end of suffering, since I first heard that phrase, it has seemed just marvelous and wondrous to me. How amazing. Can we really end our suffering? It just lights up my heart. Sometimes I feel a little bit like teenagers who were seeing the Beatles in person for the first time in 1965. You know? Oh my God, there they are! Oh my God, the end of suffering! To me, it's an amazing and extraordinary discovery of the Buddha's. And because we're so familiar with these concepts, we may get inured to them. You know, we may get, they may become too habituated in our minds to realize what a marvelous discovery it was. That he said, suffering has a cause, and that cause can be removed. If you want to get rid of the effect, remove the cause. And the Buddha's supreme insight, I think the only thing really you ever need to know, in a sense, from the Buddha's teachings is this one thing. His supreme insight is that our happiness and our misery come not from our circumstances, but rather from the way we relate to our circumstances. Again and again and again, we believe that our circumstances are causing our suffering or causing our happiness. But if you really look at it, if you look deeply at yourself and your own process, you will see actually your happiness and your misery come from how you're relating to your circumstances. In a way, you don't really need to know anything else in order to free yourself completely from your suffering. You know, you can just take this idea, you don't have to believe it, but just run with it. You know, investigate your experience. Inquire deeply into your experience. Pay attention to when things happen to you and how you're relating to them. See if it's possible to distinguish between an external event and your response to it. And then you'll see, indeed, you do cause your suffering. You perpetuate your own suffering. No one and nothing else ever cause your suffering. Your suffering is caused by your relationship to what is happening. And in the same way, you can see how you create your happiness by relating differently to your experience. No one and nothing ever caused your happiness. It's not the chocolate mousse. As much as I'd like to think it's the chocolate mousse that causes my happiness, or a great sexual experience, or whatever, it's not that thing. It's actually how I'm relating to it. So you cause your happiness by how you relate to your experience. So it's fine if you want to say, right now, thanks, Eric, that's all I need to know, see you around, and then just go off and free yourself. But for most of us, our habits of reactivity that cause our suffering are so deeply entrenched that we have to practice in order to remove the cause. And we have to practice in order to establish the cause of happiness. So the Buddha basically said that our suffering comes from three central qualities. And those three are what he called the kilesas, the root tormentors of the mind and heart. Greed, that we grasp at and cling to our pleasant experience, that reaching. Aversion, we push away unpleasant experience, we resist it. And ignorance, we space out our experience. We don't know what's happening. We're numb to it. And that can be as simple as not noticing the free machine for the check-in, or it can be as grave as not noticing that a concerted effort is being made to undermine and remove the civil and human liberties that we have, human rights that we have that are guaranteed by our Constitution. We can get numb to that as well. Just examples. It's also, ignorance is also believing to be true what is false, and believing to be false what is true. For example, the belief that things are permanent and unchanging, so there's really no danger in grasping at them and clinging to them because there's no danger of losing them. And a lot of people have that assumption. They may carry it unconsciously, but they have that assumption, and it gets them into big trouble. Or believing that things aren't impermanent. That we can rely on them to be there. So the Buddha said at one point, just simple, I didn't bring it with me, but I know the words. He said, what is the unconditioned? That's really interesting, because we talk about the unconditioned a lot, and he defined it in a really simple and practical way. He said, freedom from greed, freedom from aversion, freedom from ignorance. This is the unconditioned. You know, if you simply uproot those qualities from your mind and heart, then you will be unconditionally free. You will be unconditionally happy. The unconditioned. And just as we practice to remove the causes of suffering, our reactivity to our experience, so we also practice to create the causes of happiness. Non-greed, that is, not grasping at or clinging to our experience. We can appreciate, we can enjoy what is pleasant, but we allow it to pass away when it passes away. It's not about not enjoying. It's about not clinging. Non-aversion, not pushing away our experience, but letting the unpleasant be unpleasant. And non-delusion, knowing what is true. For example, all things are of evanescence and pass away, and to cling to them is to suffer. The Buddha said, he sometimes used very graphic metaphors, he said that to cling to anything is like holding on to a red-hot iron ball. Or he said, to cling to anything is like holding on to a venomous snake. That aspect of loving kindness, of allowing, is simply extending kindness to our experience, allowing the unpleasant to be what it is, unpleasant. And just one little example of this, in this road trip that I just took across the country, I was driving with a very dear friend. I got quite sick in the middle of the trip. I just got a cold, but it was a cold that really kind of knocked me out. And when we got to Little Rock, we gathered with two other dear friends, and we had just the most amazing day today together. It was this past Tuesday. It was one of the happiest days of my life. I was with my three closest friends, and we went to a place near Hot Springs that's a marvelous garden and nature sanctuary, Forest Preserve. It was just wonderful being with friends and being in a very beautiful place. And we walked through this sanctuary and out along a point that went into a lake. And my friend Fran turned to me as we were walking along through this forest. It was an exquisite day on Tuesday, and she said, "Do you want to get in that water as badly as I do?" And I said, "Yeah, I can taste it." And so these four geezers. One woman and three men were suddenly had all our clothes off, and we were splashing around the water like little children, and just absolutely delighted. We were like little kids, just having a very good time together. I was sick through all that. And as I look back on it, I realize that even though I was sick, I basically didn't resist the sickness. I just saw it for what it was. It was unpleasant. I know what a cold is. I know what viruses are. I know how the body responds. And I basically didn't let it impinge on me. So I was able to have one of the happiest days of my life with my friends without letting myself be hampered by the cold. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because I didn't resist it, it wasn't a problem. Okay, my energy was low, you know, my nose was streaming, all that stuff, but this is why we practice. As simple as that. To uproot all suffering by uprooting its causes. And to establish deeper and deeper happiness by cultivating its causes until happiness becomes unshakable. And then what do we practice? We practice paying close attention to our moment-to-moment experience. That is the practice of mindfulness. And that's being alert. That's the source of alertness. But our encouragement to you in our instructions is to be both tranquil, to be alert in a tranquil way. That is to rest in the mind and allow experience to come to you. And as you develop, as you cultivate that quality of simply resting in the mind and allowing experience to come, you're both tranquil and alert, and as concentration deepens, you become yet more tranquil. So we learn to relate to our experience without the clinging, the pushing away, and the misunderstanding that cause our suffering. We relate to our experience with a kind of tolerant love. So it's both mindfulness and love. And specifically what we do in our practice, I know that this information is very familiar to many of you, but it seems important for us to revisit it at the beginning of the retreat, and it's also especially important because some people haven't had exposure to these ideas. So bear with me. Specifically what we do in our practice is we practice eight things, the Noble Eightfold Path. One aspect of that practice is to purify and strengthen our good intentions, our liberating intentions, what we call right intention, to cultivate what brings us happiness, to have a clear intention to cultivate what brings us happiness, and a clear intention to uproot what brings us suffering. Without that intention, our practice can't go anywhere. From that intention, we practice, among other things, ethics. The precepts that we took earlier today that Leela described. Right speech, non-harming speech. Right action, non-harming action. And right livelihood of making our living in as harmonious and non-harming a way as we can. And that means making choices in our lives. Again, just a little example. I belong to an intentional community in Embudo, and we share a lot. We have a big community garden that's really fun. And for the first while that I was in the community, I also participated in the community chicken coop. So we all keep chickens together and we share the eggs. And then it occurred to me, oh, what happens to the chickens after they stop laying? And I realized, oh, and I asked one of my neighbors, and he said, well, we transitioned them. and I dropped out of the chicken coop. I mean, I loved participating with my community. I loved having absolutely fresh eggs. You know, I really enjoyed the whole scene. But I couldn't actually participate in something where chickens get transitioned. And that's exactly what happened. I think they know what my attitude is toward killing, and we have a disagreement about that in my community. And so they waited until I was, you know, off driving through the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia to transition 17 of the chickens, who are now in the big freezer. So we have to make choices. And sometimes they're not easy choices to make, but it's really an aspect of our practice. And then we also, from our wholesome intention, not only do we practice ethical conduct as a really profound foundation for our liberation, but we also practice meditation. The three aspects of the Eightfold Path which have to do with meditation. One is right effort. This is one of my favorite subjects. It's figuring out how to try just enough, but not to try too much. And I mean, I could talk on and on and on about, and will, about right effort, but essentially, it's to really pay attention as you practice, especially in this retreat, to what your experience is. You know, there are too many Buddhist traditions that basically tell us to make supreme effort to strive, strive, strive. In fact, we know some teachers in our own our spiritual grandfather, for one, who, you know, Upandita Sayadaw has said that if you die in practice, it's very good karma. So you'll get disagreements from some teachers, and especially from some traditions, like much of Zen, for example, about what right effort is. From my perspective, you find right effort by simply monitoring your experience. You know, and if you're feeling frustrated and disappointed, you know, this practice isn't going far enough for me, I don't know if I can really do it. If you're feeling frustrated and disappointed, you're probably trying too hard. And it's a good idea to back off and to have a more easeful practice. Remember the tranquil part of our practice. And if you feel that you're really stuck or that you're really being lazy in the practice, then it's a good idea to ramp up the effort, to come to more sittings, to have more continuity of sitting and walking. And this is an art, and it's a really a subtle art. And only you can know what right effort is for you. We can't tell you. We can give you some guidelines. I've just given you some guidelines. We can give you guidelines, but only you can tell whether you're trying too hard or trying too little. But I just encourage you to make that a part of your practice, because it's an aspect, an important aspect of the Eightfold Path. We have to get right effort right. And it's never the same for one person or another. So to compare yourself to someone else is not going to help you. You know, we all have our own balance of right effort, and it's never continuous and the same at all times for each person. There will be some days when you might want to make a real strong effort and it feels balanced, and there are other days when you might need to back off a little bit, and that's balanced too. Does this make sense? Right effort, it's a really important subject. So the basic effort is to direct our awareness toward an object and to sustain it as much as we can, sustain our attention until we get drawn away, until our mind wanders off into thought, into some story. And so the other effort is making the effort to come back, to keep coming back without judging yourself, without judging thinking, without judging your effort. Simply come back. So there's, in terms of the meditative aspects of the Eightfold Path, there's right effort, there's right mindfulness of being alert, essentially two kinds of mindfulness. One is the direct awareness, is the awareness of our experience from moment to moment. And the other is to have some understanding of the context of why we're doing what we're doing. That is an aspect of mindfulness. So you're not only paying attention to your breath, but you have some idea why it's important to pay attention to your breath. So right effort is the proximate cause. This is wonderful for right mindfulness to arise. And right mindfulness, as we practice it more and more, is the proximate cause for right concentration to arise. And that is of developing the sense of one-pointedness, of a non-wandering mind. And actually, concentration can be profound. You can have forms of happiness that you've never imagined possible simply by cultivating a deeply concentrated mind. You know, the bliss that we talk about in practice actually is an aspect of concentration. It's one of the factors that makes up concentration, one of the, what we call the jhanic factors. And rapture, this kind of delighted interest in our experience, is another aspect of concentration and profound tranquility. It's beautiful. It's a more wonderful form of happiness through concentration than any sense pleasure that we can imagine. And right concentration is the proximate cause for right understanding to arise. That's wisdom. And it's ultimately wisdom that frees us. Knowing what is true, understanding cause and effect, understanding more and more deeply that every phenomenon whatsoever in our experience, every phenomenon has three characteristics, the universal characteristics of all things. One, that they're impermanent, nothing lasts. Two, that they're unsatisfactory or unreliable because they're impermanent. And three, that nothing in our experience is self. So the Wes Nisker, whom many of you know because he's done residencies here in New Mexico, Wes Nisker summed up these three universal characteristics of phenomena using first the unsatisfactory and then the impermanent and then not self in this way. Reality sucks. It will put you through some changes. Don't take it personally. So here from the Buddha is how all of these things work together. He describes in a lovely way, you know, how a mind goes through the process of becoming free. Just two statements from the Buddha. So the Eightfold Path is made up of ethical conduct, forms of meditation, and wisdom. So he says, meditation suffused with ethical conduct becomes very fruitful. Wisdom suffused with meditation becomes very fruitful. The mind suffused with wisdom is liberated. And then this description, I love it. He said, it is natural that in a virtuous person, that is, this is our English translation, I think there are better words for it, but a virtuous, that is, of someone who is ethically non-harming. It is natural that in a virtuous person, one of consummate virtue, freedom from remorse will arise. That's the great gift of non-harming conduct, is that we're free from remorse. The gift of non-harming conduct is self-respect. It is natural that in a person free from remorse, gladness will arise. That in a glad person, rapture will arise. That is this delight or joy. That in an enraptured person, the body will be calmed. That a person of calmed body will feel pleasure. That the mind of a person feeling pleasure will become concentrated. That a person whose mind is concentrated will see things as they actually are. That a person seeing things as they actually are will grow dispassionate. That a dispassionate person will realize the knowledge and vision of release. So this is how it can work for us. It's nice that he spells it out in that way. It works. I mean, I have absolute faith that it works. All of this. I don't have any doubt at all in my own mind and heart, because I have some sense from my own experience that it works. But in order for it to work, we have to have intention. We have to be clear. If you come to a sitting and you just basically sit here and let your mind wander without trying to master it, it won't be so fruitful for you. But if you have the intention, I want to be here, I want to be present, I want to know what's happening, I want to change my relationship to what's happening, if you're clear about that, if you have that intention, you keep renewing that intention, then, as the Buddha says, your practice will be very fruitful. Among all the living beings in this great universe, I feel that you and I are very privileged. We're more privileged and fortunate than Bill Gates, and I think even more privileged and fortunate than Britney Spears. And the reason I say that, why? Because the great majority of beings, you know, way more than 99%, are likely to stay caught in the awful cycle of suffering because they don't have the information that I've just shared with you. But we have that information. We have it now. And we can take it and run with it. We know what causes our suffering. We know what can uproot it, what can bring us unshakable happiness. And for that reason, I feel that we are fortunate beyond words. I was so conscious as I was driving across the country, staying in motels and eating in restaurants and being in bus stops or truck stops, I was just so aware that most of the people around me don't have liberating information and don't have a liberating practice. So just to end with some words from Kala Rinpoche, not the present young Kalu, but the last one. It's just a very beautiful way of summing it up. He said, when you practice the holy Dharma, slowly the clouds of sorrow will drift away, and the bright sun of wisdom and great joy will be shining in the clear sky of your mind. So let's just sit for a couple of minutes.